But I'm going to follow up with the song, and I'm going to talk about love today. Now you may be thinking, it's Passover. It's the days of unleavened bread. It's about getting rid of sin. And you might be thinking, like the old Tina Turner song, what's love got to do with it? This is about sin and commandments. If you were at Passover here in Albuquerque, I kind of introduced the Passover by showing the sandwich that God, that Jesus gave regarding Passover itself as Christ began the Passover in this giving of the New Testament symbols and how he ended that evening before he went out. And I'll just turn there briefly in John chapter 13 and verse 1. John chapter 13 and verse 1. It was just before Passover. Jesus knew his time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world. Now he showed him the full extent of his love. So he introduces the concept of the New Testament Passover and his sacrifice by saying that he's showing them, he loves them, and he's showing them the full extent. He's demonstrating the full extent of his love. And as I also brought out, if you do a search through chapters 13 through 17, which we normally go through on the Passover, love is used 34 times within that context. John chapter 17, verse 26, at the conclusion of that evening, again, just before he went out, in John 17, 26, it says, I have declared to them your name, he's praying to God. And he says, I will declare it that the love with which you loved me may be in them and I in them. Passover is about God's love. It's about the love that Jesus Christ has for us, and it's about the love that he expects us to have for one another. What does it have to do with love? Indeed, he speaks of the commandments. The reference to the commandments are used in chapters 13 through 17 six times. Not the 34 with love, and often they're used only in a combination together. When you talk about God, you must talk about love. Because John 1 John 4 verse 8 says, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. How could you talk about God without an understanding of love and what love is and what it entails? How can you understand God without understanding love? Say, yeah, but for unleavened bread, I mean, shouldn't we be talking about sin and the law instead of love? Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 7. I think I also read this at Passover, but when we talk about the original Passover, the establishment of these days of unleavened bread in which we eradicate leavening from our lives for 7 days, the coming out of Egypt on towards the promised land, which of course is symbolic of our coming out of the world and into God's way of life and eventually into his promise of the kingdom of God. Deuteronomy 7 verse 6, what can be said of these people can be said of us as spiritual Israel. He says, you are a holy people to the Lord your God. And the Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself. And that can be said of the first fruits. It can be said of you when God gives you that special calling. You're a special people to God. And he says, a special treasure above all peoples on the face of the earth. Not that he doesn't love everybody, but he's chosen a few now, just like he chose his 12 disciples, and there were a few people, and there were a few that were his followers when he was on earth. But he's chosen us to be special. And he clarifies, he says, verse 7, the Lord did not set his love on you. Notice he's talking here about love in this context of the children of Israel being in Egypt and coming out and being his people. Nor choose you because you are more in number than any other people, for you are the least of all people. Compare this audience and the small groups of other people who would be obeying God on this last of the days of unleavened bread with the numbers that were at services yesterday for Easter sunrise service. Very small people. And he didn't choose us because we get a lot of people just to say the name Jesus. He called us even though we are the least of all peoples. And if you think you're the greatest of all peoples, think again. He said you're the least of all peoples, but he loves you. And it says, verse 8, but because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, he has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage and from the hand of Pharaoh the king. The Passover and the blood on the doorposts, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for you, and he brought you out of the world. Verse 9, now he says, because he loves us, and he set his love on you and he called you, there is again a reciprocation. It says, verse 9, therefore know that the Lord, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. It doesn't just say those who love him, those who accept his name. It says those who love him and keep his commandments. The love and the keeping the commandments are not separable when you're talking about both of them in the context of God. Verse 11, therefore, because he loves you, because he gave you his commandments, therefore you shall keep the commandment and the statutes and the judgments which I command you today to observe them. Because I love you, because I care for you, I've given you something here that is going to enable you to stay close to me. That's going to enable you to stay close to each other, to continue to be my people. And verse 12, New International Version says, if you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you, as he swore to your fathers. Verse 13, he will love you and bless you and increase you in numbers. And in the end, when Jesus Christ returns and the first fruits have done their part and brought others along in the 1,000 years and then in the great white throne judgment, then the increase of his government will be upon his shoulders and it will never end. So there's going to be an increase if we do what he says here to love him by keeping his commandments. You cannot know and understand God if you talk about love and the law in different contexts. You cannot know and love God if you talk about the law and love in different contexts, because they go together when you're talking about God. They are inseparable. John chapter 14 and verse 21 says, there are those in Christianity who would emphasize the law and that be the important thing, that I keep the law strictly, exactly, Pharisaically, if you will. And there are those who say, oh, we just love Jesus, I love God, and avoid the law. Neither can be done and know God. John 14, verse 21, it says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them is he who loves me." When you read about those who would diminish the Ten Commandments, they would say, well, he's just talking about Jesus' commands, these new commands that have nothing to do with the law. And people began to say that just even after Christ had ascended to heaven and Christianity began to develop. And John himself clarifies it later, and we'll read that in just a second. But he says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." It's about love. That love that was you sang about here just a few moments ago, that it can't be separated as long as we don't separate ourselves from him. 1 John chapter 5. And again, as people began to understand that there was something special about Jesus Christ, and they began to turn to what is God's way of life and Christianity, many began to misunderstand love and the law. And John again is clarifying, and people who would say, well, the commandments aren't necessary, we just love God. 1 John 5, 2, he says, "By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God." Oh, but I love God. But it says, "Love God and obey his commandments." Verse 3, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments." People began to separate them and say, one is more important than the other, or one is necessary and the other is not. I'll just quote it, but the prophecy happens and says of things happening near the end and near the time that John wrote what he just did, we read, that people began to lose it. Matthew 24, verse 12, it says, "Because lawlessness will abound." Now you start doing away with law, you start doing away with God's commandments and not keeping his commandments, what happens? You remember the rest of that? "Because lawlessness will abound, the result is the love of many will wax cold." You lose the law, you lose love. You don't love if you don't keep God's commandments. The sermon title today, if you like titles, is Love and the Law. Love and the Law. It is essential to understand how the law shows love and how love defines the law. It's essential to understand how the law shows love and love defines the law. Matthew chapter 22. Matthew 22. I mean, we ourselves can begin to miss focus and to lose the full intent of what God expects us to know and to understand if we don't understand them in their mixed context. Matthew 22, verse 36, and people wanted to nitpick and they wanted to focused on one thing and trying to see who could be the most righteous person by their most righteous act. And he says, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" I mean, if I just like had to pick one I could really focus on and get good at, you know, and kind of not worry about the others. Well, which one would I really gain more points with? Verse 37, Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Verse 38, "This is the first and great commandment." And verse 39, "The second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. This is what it's all about. It's about love. Love's got to do with everything that has to do with God. It's about love. Now, you notice when he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and people take that and says, well, just love God. You know, that's the main focus, and he was getting away from the Ten Commandments. No, he says the commandments hang on that. Where did that come from? Did Christ just all of a sudden make that up? No, it was in his heart, in his mind, through eternity. Because Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, where he had given the Ten Commandments and rehearsed those Ten Commandments in chapter 5, Deuteronomy 6, 5 says just what Christ said, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. I've given you some of these commandments to show you how to do that. You know, when Christ says, a new law I give unto you, that you love one another, he wasn't saying those other commandments aren't necessary. Not what he was saying. He was saying, really, you didn't keep that law in the way I intended you to keep it. And so the new law basically is trying to help you get it in your heart and in your mind and use my Holy Spirit to help you to do the things that I ask you to. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. Leviticus 19 and verse 18. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is again quoting himself from the Old Testament. Leviticus 19, verse 18. Now he says, do not seek revenge, which is an act. If you seek revenge, well, I'm going to get him by hurting him, killing him, stealing from him, whatever. I'm going to get them back, putting them down, taking away the honor of their name, whatever it is. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge. Bearing a grudge of and by itself is not an act. It is an attitude. It's something in the heart. It's something that is in here. And it says, don't keep something in your heart where you have something against someone to where you would then act on it and seek revenge. So here he's showing both the act and the attitude. And he says, so don't seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. You love your neighbor by your actions, and love your neighbor by what's in your heart. Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. Those who want to nitpick and misunderstand the law will say that when there are quotes like this, well, he says these things here, but since he doesn't mention everything, he doesn't mean the others. Instead of, okay, he's just giving kind of a little summary here to help you get the point across. You don't have to list them all if you have them in your heart. Romans chapter 13, verse 9. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet, and if there be any other commandment, well, of course there are. Which ones of the others do you eliminate? It is briefly comprehended in this saying. Really, if you, well, it says you shall love your neighbor as yourself. What it has to do with dealing with one another, if you have the love of God, then you won't do those things. It just kind of sums it up. So love your neighbor as yourself. Verse 10, love works no ill to his neighbor, whether in act or in attitude. Love does not revenge or bear a grudge. They go together. Okay. Love works no ill towards his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Again, they're inseparable. try to do one without the other, it's not possible to do it in a godly way. Sure, a lot of people do it, or they think they love, but do away with the commandments, and they don't. You can keep a certain amount of commandments and still not keep the commandments if you don't love and understand what they're about. Ten Commandments are not just an abstract set of conducts, of concepts or conduct showing us about life or good citizenship. They're about relationships with God and with man. God's looking for the heart and the attitude. Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah chapter 31. And we're talking about this evening when you go out to dinner after sunset, if you do so, you're going to be ordering that roll, which you avoided, or at least most of you avoided before. But it doesn't mean that the meaning of Passover and the days of unleavened bread is done. If we have these things in our hearts and in our minds, we carry on the real meaning of it. And that's what God is after. In Jeremiah 31, verse 31, it says, "The days are coming, says the Lord, when I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And it wasn't that what he gave them initially was not correct or that it was not complete. The incompleteness was in the way they took it and the way they mishandled it. Verse 32, "Not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt." Again, what did he want from them when he made them a special people and led them out? What does he want from us now? And here he's focusing specifically on a spiritual Israel and the meaning of these days of coming out of Egypt. It says, "My covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord." Now, he's putting this in the context of a relationship. I was a husband to them, and most people can understand, you know, whether you've been married or not, the husband-wife relationship, because everybody's got parents, or even if their parent died early, they were with in a foster home with some parents, husband and wife, and everybody understands to some degree the husband-wife relationship. And he says, "I was a husband to them. I wanted a relationship, not just a government, not just a nation that I could be over. I wanted a relationship with these people." Verse 33, but says, "This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, and that he makes with us when we accept that sacrifice and repent and come up the new person and have God's Spirit." He says, "I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I'll be their God, and they will be my people." The law, you can't do away with the law and love God. Because if you really love God, the law will be in your mind and in your heart, in the way you act towards him, the way you act towards one another. Notice he explains the law, again, in terms of relationship. I was a husband to them. The Pharisees didn't understand that. They understood the law. They understood the law as far as its shell very well. But they didn't understand what God was saying here. And they tried to separate them by their actions. Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. Verse 1, I'll be reading out of the New Living Translation here. Mark 7, verse 1 says, "One day some of the Pharisees and teachers of religious law," the scribes, I mean, they knew the law better than anybody else. They knew how to keep their version of the law or to keep the law in a strict ritualistic fashion more than any other people. And they felt that that would keep them in a good relationship with God, because Israel and Judah had rejected God. And a lot of it was because they rejected the Sabbath. They rejected the law about worshiping other gods and making idols and all of those things. And they had rejected, and they'd been taken into captivity. And so the scribes and the Pharisees, the scribes in particular, got together and they said, here's the law. We don't want to lose the law or we'll lose God. But they didn't understand the love aspect of it. Verse 2, they noticed, in observing Jesus and some of his followers, that his disciples failed to follow the Jewish ritual of hand washing before eating. Now, is there anything wrong with washing your hands before eating? Hope not, because otherwise your kids are going to be saying, I don't have to. Because I always tell your kids, wash your hands before you eat. Hopefully before you cook your dinner, wash your hands. Lave sus manos. You know, and you go in the restroom and it says all employees must wash their hands. Nothing wrong with washing your hands. A lot of the things that the Pharisees and the scribes did came from some of the rules that Jesus made, because they're good for you. Okay? And they would take that and says, we do what God says to do in washing. I mean, you look at what the priest had to do when he went into the temple, into the Holy of Holies. He had a lot of ritualistic things to do, and they did them very well. And he explains, verse 3, this is parenthetically here in the the New Living Translation has a little parenthesis here in verse 3. It says the Jews, especially the Pharisees, do not eat until they poured water over their cupped hands as required by their ancient traditions, and somewhat based upon some of the ritual of God's law. This is but one of many traditions they have clung to, such as their ceremonial washing of cups and pitchers and kettles. Now, you would have to admit, hopefully all of us here, that washing things is not a bad idea. Most of you have dishwashers or children. God is interested in cleanliness. He's interested in you washing your pots and pans after you eat, before if necessary. He's interested in you washing your hands, because of rules of cleanliness. And they were very good at washing pots and cups and hands. And they thought they were doing God a great service by that and action. There are some of the commandments that we can do, the Ten Commandments we can do in a very ritualistic fashion and believe we're doing God a service. And in a sense we are, because the more good we do, such as washing your hands before you eat, and your pots and pans after you eat, they're good things. But that's not what God is looking for in us inside. Verse 6, Jesus replied, you hypocrites. Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They're keeping the law and separating it from love. They're separated. Their hearts are far from me. They got law, but they don't have the heart. And the result is, it says, verse 9, and he said, you skillfully sidestepped God's law in order to hold on to your own traditions. And sometimes we sidestep God's law in order to, or God's law, God's intent of the law of love, by keeping our own tradition of the law, even as moral law. For instance, let me give you for instance, he says, verse 10. For instance, Moses gave you This law from God, honor your father and your mother, and anyone who speaks disrespectfully of father or mother must be put to death. Verse 11, but you say it's all right for people to say to their parents, sorry, I can't help you, for I vowed to give to God what I would have given to you. I gave an offering. You know, I had my little green envelope, and I put that in the basket. And because I put a lot of little green envelopes in the basket, and because I sent my tithes regularly, and because I've done this, then that kind of relieves me a little bit from some of that love stuff, from some of the stuff that matters to God. Now, the one does not relieve you of the other. Verse 12, in this way, you let them disregard their needy parents. And verse 20, and he added, it is what comes from inside you that defiles you. For from within, out of a person's heart, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality. Now we're talking about, he's talking about these commandments that we break when our heart is evil. We don't have God's love towards people. Sexual immorality, theft, murder. And he's listing the commandments. Verse 22, adultery, greed, covetousness, stealing, wickedness, deceit, don't lie, lustful desires, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. You break God's commandment from your heart. You keep God's commandment from your heart if you have God's love. If you understand what that law is about and the damage you're doing if you're not doing God's way. Verse 23, all these vile things come within and they are what defile you. You can wash pots and pans and you can have clean cups all day. And you can lave sus manos from here on out. But if you don't have a care for people, if you're washing your hands because the sign says you must wash your hands, instead of realizing that, you know, if I've got some kind of filth on my hands after going to the bathroom, and I make up a meal, and I transfer that filth to somebody else and they get sick, I could make somebody sick, the one I'm trying to serve. And that's not very kind. Internalizing why you do what you do. You don't wash your pots and pans after you eat. And then stuff starts gathering and bacteria starts getting on them and things that the next time you eat and you haven't washed your pots and pans, that one of your family could get sick. Or the people that you serve get sick. It's not showing love. You see, there's a doing of them, and there's a doing of them for the reason that we do them. This is what God's interested in with the law. Our houses could be spotless. We could go through and not find a fortune cookie for unleavened breads from here on out. But if our hearts aren't right, we have failed. Passover and unleavened bread 101. You know, the real basic meaning of what God wants us to do with putting leavening out of our lives. It's not just the ritual. Now, we do ritualistically put out our leaven and eat unleavened stuff. And we will continue to do so. And that's all right. It's a command. We must. Because it reminds us of the things that he really wants from us, and that's what's in our heart. As I inferred a minute ago, even keeping the Ten Commandments without love is not keeping the Ten Commandments. It's a ritual. You can keep the Ten Commandments, but if you keep it without love, 1 Corinthians 13:2 says, without love, you're nothing. Sounding brass, tinkling cymbal. I don't care how many things you've done. I don't care how many good deeds you do. If you don't do it for the right reason, it sounds hollow to God. in Matthew 23, verse 2, Jesus said, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. Okay, these guys understand the law better than most. And what did he say about them? Matthew 23, 2, Jesus said, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. And then he says, so practice and observe what they tell you, but not what they do. They'll tell you to keep the Sabbath. They'll tell you to keep the holy days. They'll tell you to put leavening out of your homes during unleavened bread. Do what they say, because they carry on the law, but they don't understand the law inside. Don't do what they do, because they don't practice the law the way I intend for you to. Mark Twain was talking to a, I guess, kind of a shady businessman back in his day. And this businessman was saying, I mean to take a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And I will climb to the top of Mount Sinai. And I will read the Ten Commandments aloud. Mark Twain says, I have a better idea. You could stay in Boston and keep them instead. We can loudly proclaim the Ten Commandments, but God's better idea is that we keep them. Okay, we know what the meaning is. I'd like to just take the rest of the time here and review the Ten Commandments and discuss a little bit how they are a relationship and show love for God and love for man. On these commandments, love God and love man, hang all the law. And that keeping the commandments is not just about washing pots and pans or even about keeping the Sabbath or putting away unleavened bread. It is about the intent of those things. Exodus chapter 20, and we're going through the Ten Commandments in our youth lessons and expounding on them with our youth. But think about this in terms of what God wants. He wants something from our heart, something from our mind, our attitude, in our dealings with him and with others. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, he says, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Again, back to the lesson of these days of unleavened bread and Passover. And he says, you shall have no other gods before me. If we truly believe in and love God, how could we do anything else? You know, he says, they rejected me, although I was a husband to them. And he's a husband to us. And I think using that analogy and that relationship as Jesus does, he says, I speak of the church when he talks of a husband and wife. And he says, because there is a way that husbands and wives relationally need to treat each other, he says, that's why we need to think of God and treat him as he treats us with love. We show appreciation for the calling, for the sacrifice and love that God gave to us and that Jesus gave to us by putting God first in what we think and we say and we do. Now, you're sitting here today because you put God first ahead of going somewhere else and doing something else, whether it be work or pleasure. And you did not put some other God before the true God. When you had a meal during this week, you sat down and you ordered depending on what was unleavened, in which with some restaurants is very little. But you put God first and said, this is what he says to do. And yeah, I have a great desire to have a great big hamburger bun or a roll in the morning or a donut or whatever. But I'm putting God first. It's because you care what God thinks. And hopefully you didn't do it just because, well, if I don't, he'll strike me dead. or if I don't, he'll be mad and I won't get stuff. It's because you really care about what God thinks. That's what he wants. If we showed interest and respect for a person other than our spouse, ahead of our spouse would be very angry at that, and it would not be showing love. But we defer to our mate, we defer to our children, we defer to those that we love by putting them ahead of our own desires. If you say, I'm only faithful to my mate because I have to be, because God says don't commit adultery. I'd really like to commit adultery. You know, that's your heart and your attitude. You don't really love your spouse. If you don't commit adultery because, you know, it hurts you, it hurts her, it hurts all those around you, then you understand. You don't put other gods ahead of God because it's an adulterous relationship, as Israel did. Number two says in verse 4 of Exodus 20, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness or anything that's in heaven above or earth beneath or the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. He is jealous of us. It's a relationship. You know, there is a jealousy in our relationship. We want the love and affection of our mate. We want the love and affection of our children, of our brethren. And when that love and affection is given elsewhere, it is damaging. And he says, visiting the iniquity of the fathers to the children, the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And he says, there is penalty for sin, because when you sin against your children by abuse or by lack of love or whatever else, it has a lasting effect down through the time. And it's not showing love. He says, but showing mercy to thousands. Notice what he says here, to those who love me and keep my commandments. He doesn't say just to those that love me. He doesn't say just to those that keep my commandments. But he says those that love me and keep my commandments. Understand that they go together in their concepts. That image that says we can bow down to can be the image of another god, like the golden calf. You know, it would be like worshiping pornography instead of your wife. You know, putting that image there instead of that you have vowed your love to. It says suppose, or it can be a supposed image of what we think God looks like. A lot of people bow down to that. They got pictures of Jesus there. Oh, I'm worshiping Jesus. That, I think, might be a lot like, let's say that if your wife was good at Photoshop and she took your picture and then Photoshopped a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger 30, 40 years ago and says, okay, I really love my husband, man. He's a hunk. It would be making an image out of your husband that is not your husband. And, you know, looking after somebody else. So people do that with God. They put pictures of Jesus that aren't pictures of Jesus. They make him over into what they want him to be. We can violate this command by creating God in our image. It's like a woman that sees a man that she would like to marry and says, okay, I'd like to marry him, but I'll need to change that. I'll need to change that. And given enough time, I can change that. And then you can make him over into what you want. Now, most women do that anyway. and love the person they end up changing. But, you think about it. If you say, well, I could marry them if they had this quality, or I could marry them if they had that quality, so I'll change them to make them into that. Well, now it's not who that person is. That wouldn't really be loving that person, be loving the image that you're trying to create them into being. And again, people do that with God. People make him into the God of Christmas and Easter. They make him into the God of Sunday. You know, people want God to accept me just the way I am. But they don't want to accept God just the way he is. They want to change him into something more comfortable for them. It's not loving an individual when we do that. It is not loving God when we do that. This making an image, we can put other things like television, cars, people ahead of God. And what happens in a family when a person does that, when they're spending all the guy's spending all his time out in the shop and doesn't have time for the kids, doesn't have time for the wife? Or, you know, the wife is off with the girls and doesn't have time for the family, the husband. You know, it's an alienation of affection. And we can tell our family by words and deeds that we prefer other things to them. And God says, don't do that to me. We tell God that he is second to whatever. And then we don't show love towards him. We say, God, I would rather, you know, make some money on a holy day rather than show up on a holy day and give an offering. Well, obviously, we'd be putting other things before God. But he wants our heart. We put him first. Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. No person can say, well, I don't cuss. I never did cuss. My mama taught me it was wrong to cuss and never said a bad cuss word in my life. Okay, got number three down. Now I'll move on. You know, what does he mean by don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain? What is he looking for in your heart? Let's use an example. John chapter 15. John chapter 15. So we see these laws aren't just about don't set a golden calf up and bow down and worship it. It's about the attitude behind why you don't want to do that. It's about you love God so much you wouldn't do that. You really care for him and want to put him first. John 15, verse 12, Jesus said, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. And then he says, verse 13, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Now, that's, of course, what Jesus did on that evening, on Passover. He laid down his life for us, his friends. And he showed love for us by demonstrating what love is. And as we read from John chapter 13, where he says he demonstrated his final and greatest act of love. Okay, so he says, if I do that for you, you lay down your lives for your fellows, for other people in the church, other people in the world, our families. We lay down our lives for others. That is who he is. And if we do that, we take on his name. Now, John chapter 13, verse 37, here's Peter, one of his followers, and said, I am a disciple of Jesus. I have taken on his name as his disciple. You know, we're the United Church of God. We've got a name, the United Church of God, and we should do things that befit what we stand for. John 13, 37, Peter said to him, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. You know, you say, greater love has no man than this. He laid down his life for his brother. I'm a follower of you. As a disciple, I'm taking on your name. I'm willing to die for you. Which is what we all sign on to, don't we? We say, God, you say do this. I'm a follower. I'm a Christian. Follower of Christ. I will do what you ask me to do. I'm taking on your name. And people will call me a Christian because I do what Christ did. and does. Verse 38, Jesus answered him, "Will you lay down your life for my sake?" He said you would. You've taken on my name as a disciple and said you would do what I ask you to do in giving to others. He says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you've denied me three times. You will say, you say now, I am a disciple of Christ. I will lay down my life for you because I love you." And he says, "Will you?" And he took the name of God in vain by his promise and by his action. Because Peter, in taking the name of a disciple of Jesus and taking the challenge, took his name in vain. I'll just read Mark 14:71. "And Peter began to curse and swear and saying, 'I don't know this man of whom you speak.'" And even by his language, he was taking the name in vain by cursing and swearing, but he was in a greater fashion taking his name by denying him and not being a follower. He demonstrated his lack of love. He demonstrated his lack of respect by cursing and denying his name. We have taken on the name of God at baptism. You're baptized into the name of the Father and the Son. We've taken on the name of God and given his Holy Spirit, then we carry on to do so. Following through and honoring him by obeying and laying down our lives for the brethren, that is love for God. Being like him demonstrates love for God and love for Jesus Christ and an appreciation for what he did for us. So we take his name and we don't take it in vain. No, we don't want to take on the name and then deny it. You know, there are certain famous names, and really when you look at through history, there are very few names that have been truly honorable, but still, you know, you say, "Well, you do this because you're a Kennedy." And a lot of them did what they did because they're a Kennedy, but he's supposed to, you know, Camelot, the respected name, or do this because you are a royal. And of course, we see the royals aren't very royal. But there's supposed to be a certain demeanor, a certain action. Because while I love my country, England, and so as a royal, I will try not to do something that would defame it. I'm a senator, and I love my country, and I want to do things that are honorable for the country and to move it forward. And we know, obviously, that people are flawed with it, but I think a lot of these people, I take the name of a senator because I love the people and want to serve them. We take the name of God, and we really should do it because we love him, we want to honor him, and don't want to bring shame to his name. Okay, number four, Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8. "Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord, and you shall do no work, nor your son, your daughter, your male servant, female, your cattle, your stranger in your gates. For 6 days the Lord made heaven, earth, and sea, and all that's in them. The seventh day he rested. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it." Well, people look at it as a day. This is a day that we worship on, and we're keeping the commandment. We're not keeping the commandment if we're keeping a day. We keep the day, but why the day, and what do we do with the day? We show that we love God and man when we specifically set aside that day, because what do we do with the day? We honor him by not pursuing our own ways. We're saying, "God, I'm doing as you say, and setting that aside a day which I can concentrate more on you instead of concentrate more on me and the things that I get involved with all during the week." And so I am following through with the day, not because it is a 24-hour period of time, but because it's a 24-hour period of time dedicated to you. It's a period of time that we can learn more about him through discussing his word. It's about a relationship with God. It's not about a 24-hour period of time. Although we do, as he commands, and take that 24-hour time to do that. We show love for others of his flock by service and assembly. You know, he says, if you've done it to the least of these, you have done it unto me. And so we come, and we sometimes involve setting up chairs or playing an instrument or just talking with someone and helping them through a difficult time or whatever. But we're honoring and worshiping God by focusing on him and those he has called. And again, it's about a day. I mean, it's about a relationship with our Creator, not a day. It's about clearing our schedule so we can spend quality time getting to know God by loving God and loving one another. The exceptions that Jesus did regarding the Sabbath had to do with relationships. You know, he was healing a person on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees came and said, you're violating this day. Okay, how is it I'm violating this day? Basically, Jesus was asking. What principle of love am I violating by doing this? If I didn't heal, what principle of love would I violate by not healing? And it wasn't about the day, it was about the relationship. The disciples were picking and eating grain on the way through, my guess is from one synagogue to the other, morning service to afternoon. And so the disciples would just have a good Sabbath and enjoy it and pick a few handfuls of grain on their way. And the Pharisees said, they are violating the Sabbath. In what way did I violate a relationship with God and a relationship with man by grabbing a handful of grain on my way from one service to the other? The Pharisees focused on the day, not the meaning of the day. It's about relationships, not just rules. Regarding an activity during that 24-hour period that God sets aside for us, we need to ask, does this activity show love for God and love for man? It's not a day about self-gratification. It's not a day about making money. It's going out and doing your job and focusing on whatever you have to focus on during the day and go out and make money have to do with loving God and loving your fellow man. So while I'm making money so I can put food on the table for my... Some of that is justification. Our own pursuits. You know, how does a football game show love for God? How is that doing? Now you're there watching a football game, and so I'm loving God by... You'd really have to stretch it, I think, by seeing how evil these people are. Yeah, that's it. Or watching a suspense movie or whatever, where you're involved in all that's going on there. And how are you showing love for your family, love for your brother, love for God? Some people are more concerned about the degree of the sun at the end of a day than they are the degree of love they have for those that they're serving, or the degree of love they have for God in the attitude. Okay, it's 7:39. Okay, now I can do what I want. Or at 7:38, I can still do this, you know, when it's Friday night. Now 7:39, oh man, I can't do that anymore. You know, and it's a focus about the day rather than what is it about. Oh good, the Sabbath is coming and it's getting pretty close to sundown. And man, I get to put all this stuff away and I get to, you know, think about what we're going to be doing with services or with one another or with our study or whatever it might be. It's about a relationship. Number five, Exodus 20 and verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Well, parenting is hard. It's an act of love. And we expect reciprocation, actually. I tell my kids they need to get good jobs so they can support me in my old age. I mean, I supported you. You honor me. It costs the... To raise a child in the United States from birth to 18 costs an average of $200,000. Okay, so kids are spending a lot of money on you, even though sometimes it doesn't seem like it's enough. On the other hand, to get to the other end of it, which a lot are experiencing right now, it costs about $5,500 a year for a relative or friend just for the day-to-day expenses like food, doctor visits, taking them to the visits and everything to take care of a parent. Now, if you have an assisted living facility, it costs about $36,000 a year if you're taking care of that parent if they haven't provided for themselves. If you put them in a nursing home, $69,000 a year. So, you know, they get back when you're honoring them. But really, what honoring your father and your mother about, it includes an esteem of them shown in our conduct. And again, obedience to their lawful commands. And of course, this gets a little difficult when parents are not honorable. And there have been parents that aren't honorable and have not given lawful commands, you know, and having them do something that is not godly. But when we give honor to our parents, and we, all things considered, we're showing love for them. Jesus, or God said, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Why? It's because the Son followed through with the Father's directives and the Father's will. And he acted and behaved in a worthy manner. He took care of Mary. John, take care of my mother when I'm gone. He showed respect. It's natural for children to want to please their parents, actually. You know, and it doesn't seem like it sometime when you go through certain phases, because society will start playing different tricks on kids and say, well, you don't really love your parents, do you? No, no. But a child really wants to please his parent and do a good thing and please the parent, and the parent say, you're my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Good job. I mean, even Marlia, when she goes and sits on a pot and does what the kid did, good job. You know, they want to please the parent. My parent's going to say, good job if I do this thing. You know, and if we continue that, it's why. Do you want your children to love you just because you're a good disciplinarian, or to do the right thing because you're a good disciplinarian? You know, I've got my kids, they're perfect, they're doing as they're told, they march lockstep, and they sit down in church and never say a word. Or do you want them to do it because they love you and because they don't want to dishonor your name? And this commandment, too, is about love, not just doing something. Exodus 20, verse 13, you shall not murder. Number 6, you shall not murder. You know, Jesus puts it as well as anybody could in bringing it down to what this law is really all about. It's not just about, and when we baptize somebody and they say, no, which commandments have you broken? Well, see, I haven't broken the law of murder. That's what I'm good at. I haven't really stolen much, and I haven't really done much, you know, but murder, no, I haven't done that. Matthew 5:21, Jesus brings it down to what it's about. It's not about just the law of murder. Good, you never murdered anyone, you're good. Come on into the kingdom. Matthew 5:21, you've heard that people were told in the past, don't commit murder. Anyone who does will be brought to trial. In verse 22, but now I tell you, whoever is angry at his brother will be brought to trial. That's an attitude inside. That's like, you can seek revenge or hold a grudge. Holding the grudge is what's inside. Whoever calls his brother you good for nothing will be brought before the council. Whoever calls his brother a worthless fool will be in danger of going to the fire of hell. Jesus teaches us how to regard the life and character of others as we would our own. This is about not slandering. This is about not tearing down other people, about having a care for other individuals. It forbids envy and malice, gossip, anger, insulting language. On the contrary, it requires a spirit of kindness, a spirit of forgiveness. And that's inside. You can not kill somebody, but you can really hold something against them. It has to do with love. Yesterday, those of you that were at my son-in-law's and daughter's place, across the street is a school, and I was going to take them to the playground yesterday. So I had Blake and Marlia. And directly across from it's a school, right? And so we go outside the gate, and Blake says, we need to go down to the crosswalk. Because if we don't use the crosswalk, a car will come along and kill us. And he says, God doesn't want his people to be killed. It's because God loves us, right? He doesn't want his people to be killed. I'm glad he's getting that concept. God doesn't want his people to be killed. He doesn't, and that's what we should want, is we don't want people to have a bad name because of us. We don't want people to have a bad reputation because of us. We don't want people's sins spread before the world because of us. Because we love them, we don't want them run over by our words, by our actions. This is an unleavened attitude of humility and respect for others. It's about caring for and loving people. That's what that commandment is about. Verse number 7, you shall not commit adultery. This concerns purity and respect for what God has created. 1 Peter 1, verse 13. First Peter 1, verse 13. Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Be self-controlled. Verse 14, as obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires that you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he has called you is, just as he who has called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it's written, be holy because I am holy. This law against adultery pollutes the imagination. It pollutes the thought. It raises improper passions. Not showing love for God. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It shows lack of love for God and lack of love for others. First Corinthians 6:18, it says, flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but whoever commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you're not your own? You're bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and your spirit, which were God's. If sex were a Lexus, and God says, I'm giving you this brand new Lexus as a gift, would it be showing love for God to take your key that he gave you to get into Lexus, assuming you buy one that needs one, and you walk down the side of that car and make a big scrape in the side the first time you get it. You key it. Or you run out of gas for the first tank and you decide to fill it with water because it's cheaper. Now, how would that be showing love for God who gave you that car? Well, it wouldn't be, right? It'd be showing a great deal of respect for God. Be showing a great deal of respect for your family, who, if you put water in the gas tank, can't drive around it anymore. And God gave us our bodies, which are his temple. And he says, take care of it. And sexual immorality, adultery, fornication is showing disrespect for God in that which he has made, which is our bodies he gave us to honor him. Number 8, you shall not steal. Exodus 20:15. It's a law of love that, as it respects the property of others. Everything you have is a trust that God has given to you. And he says, I want you to take care of that trust. We need to be industrious in what we do. We need to be frugal, not wasters of things. And we can steal by wasting. We can steal by defrauding people, deceiving for gain. I mean, you look at the world now and the condition that we're in financially. It's because people wanted to steal from others. And that's essentially what's happened to the banking industry. Is they, you know, had a great inflated price on a home. They said you could have that much worth, and now it's not. I mean, it's a stealing because of greed. We had a policeman in Phoenix who defrauded the bank and lied on the application in order to be able to get money to finance his home. Well, he was stealing because he was lying, and stealing and lying is not showing concern for another individual. It is greed, a focus on self. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, there are people who will live on charity when it is not necessary. Now, there are times when living on others is necessary. God says, take care of the widow. You know, those who don't have, or whose husband had died and they don't have a way to support themselves. And we have our welfare system in this country, and for the most part, it works okay. But there are others. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, he says, well, even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither should he eat. It's an individual that could work, had the ability to, but was too lazy. Or, as in this case, he was too focused on prophecy and getting out there and figuring out the time of the end. And since it's the time of the end, well, I shouldn't work, and we should all put our things together, and you should give me a bunch of things. Basically stealing from people. Verse 11, for we hear there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. In other words, you give me what is yours. Well, it's a stealing. Well, it wouldn't have to be that way. Not showing love to those who would sacrifice to support you. We can steal a reputation from someone by gossip. They have a reputation. We spread something about it. We lie a little bit in the form of just information. We've stolen from their reputation. It's not just, I didn't steal it, but it's, I didn't steal it because it's theirs. It's a care for them. It's a love for them. And we care for one another so we don't take from them. Number 9, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. It's possible this commandment is broken more than most of the others combined. Exodus 20, verse 16, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Slander. Digging up dirt. Finding out what somebody did and letting other people know about it. Believing the worst. damaging a person's reputation. You know, I'm pretty sure we're all guilty of doing that, where we know something about something, and maybe we don't know everything. Maybe that other thing would make it to where it's not like it appears. You know, we can say, well, this person, stole from somebody because that's why they got so much stuff. Well, maybe they got a lot of stuff because they inherited it. And you could get people think, well, they're an evil person because they got a lot of stuff. We can try to raise our own reputation at the expense of another's good name. Do we sometimes do like the Pharisees? You know, we'll take a commandment, we say, I'm really good at this commandment, but at least I don't do that. Sure, I might spread rumors. Sure, I might imply evil motives to people, but I keep the Sabbath more strictly than they do. Luke chapter 18. Now, sometimes we like to overlook this particular commandment. There's been a lot of overlooking that. And again, I use the internet every day, but boy, there's been a lot of evil with that. You know, because you can write something and type it and put out a statement that may or may not be true, but gets around enough, becomes true, whether it's true or not. And we ought not be guilty of bearing false witness against a neighbor. Luke 18, verse 9, Jesus told a story. Some had great confidence in their own righteousness and scorned everyone else. Verse 10, two men went to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other a despised tax collector. Pharisee stood by himself and prayed this prayer, I thank you, God. I am not a sinner like everyone else. I don't cheat. I don't sin. I don't commit adultery. I'm certainly not like that tax collector. Sometimes we do that with this, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Yeah, I know. Well, we gossiped about that person, and we said something about him. It might not be true, but it might be, though, or it probably is. But at least I keep the Sabbath. I fast twice in a week. I give a tenth of my income. I know I gave a great big offering. That's going to buy me permission to gossip. Tax collector stood at a distance, dared not even lift his eyes to heaven and prayed. And instead, he beat his chest in sorrow, saying, God, be merciful to me. I'm a sinner. I tell you, the sinner, not the Pharisee, returned home justified before God. Let's say you can keep the commandments of God, but not keep the commandments of God. Keeping the Sabbath really, really strictly does not justify you from not loving your brother by not bearing false witness, by doing some of the others. And here's the person who knew that he was a sinner, and he's more justified than the Pharisee who did a lot of good stuff. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. God insists on keeping his laws with the right attitude. It's not just an act, it's an attitude. Number 10, Exodus 20:17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that's your neighbor's. Covetousness strikes at the root cause of most sin. We want something that we don't have. We want something that is theirs. We deserve that. Many of the other commands forbid you from doing harm to others. This one says even wanting something else of someone else's, it's not yours. It's a sin of the mind. Desire of having something that will gratify yourself. Satan coveted God's position. He coveted God's power. He wanted what was God's. When we complain, we don't show appreciation for what we've been given. Coveting is seeing what somebody else has, and we want that. When we're in a particular circumstance that we don't like, and we say, well, I don't like this, and so I want it to be different, and we complain about what we've got, that's coveting. 3 John, verse 1. Notice this person who coveted. You know, we can look at Satan and what happened when Satan coveted, and it turned into a whole series of sins. 3 John 1, verse 9. John says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence, he coveted a position. He coveted preeminence. He coveted looking good. And he says, I want to be the one everybody looks to. I want to be the one that people feel is like has the answers to the Bible. I want to be the one who people will turn to. And he coveted preeminence. And what did he do as a result? Diotrephes, who loves to have preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. So his coveting, wanting a position, then turned into deeds of sin, which were malicious words, slandering, bearing false witness, murder, in other words. And not content with that. He wanted it so badly that whatever it took, he would do to get it. All in the name of God. All in the name of the church. He's not showing love for anybody around him. He does not receive the brethren that just want to serve God. He forbids those who wish by putting them out of the church. He coveted enough power where he could say, you can't attend here. We don't like you. Verse 11, behold, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. For he who does good is of God, and he who does evil has not seen God. Because God is love. And lawlessness abounds, there is no love. So you start prating against others with malicious words. You start putting others down. It's not showing love. Coveting is the beginning of a lot of those things. Covetousness results in doing evil. Evil is not of God, because God is love. Ask God to help you love and to keep his law in sincerity and truth. You know, the Bible talks about the days of unleavened bread being about sincerity and truth. Sincerity and truth has to do with our love of God and our love of man and our hearts and keeping the truth and his law. Have a contrite and humble spirit. That's love. Keeping the law is not an end in itself. Keeping the law is a means of expressing love to God and love to man. You don't do away with one or the other. As we consider the deep meaning of Passover and unleavened bread, we all need to respond to the loving sacrifice of God the Father and of Jesus Christ by eliminating the leaven of sin by the love of God.